if you are willing to wake up in the morning and you're reasonably nice and you live in the developed world, the world is set up for you. Like, you can't, it's just really hard to fail. So my position has always been, look, I'm not going to fail. It's fine. I mean, I'll like figure a way. And it's, you know, knock on wood, so far things have worked out pretty well. So I feel like what prevents people from sometimes doing interesting things is they have an anxiety about stepping outside of a narrow definition of what they're good at. I don't.
That was Malcolm Gladwell. I'm Sam Fragoso, and this is Talk Easy. Welcome to the show. Hey everyone, this is Sam, and I just wanted to do some housekeeping at the top before we listen to Malcolm Gladwell. We are on a kind of hiatus here for the next 5 weeks. We'll be returning on August 25th with the wonderful Whitney Cummings, but until then, for the next 5 weeks, we are not going to go away. We are going to re-release some of my favorite conversations that we've had on this podcast over the past 3 years. Those of you who've been listening from the beginning have probably heard all of these, but we've been finding that a great deal of our new listeners have not experienced our back catalog, all of which is for free and can be streamed and downloaded on Spotify, iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, wherever you're getting your podcasts. But since we are in the throes of summer, And people are out of town, on vacation, their kids are at home all day, every day. I know it is a time where, people have less time. And quite frankly, in the interest of transparency, we have found that booking the show week after week in the summer is really, really challenging. And we decided just to not even, I'm going to take a break. I have a new movie that I am writing and hopefully going to direct in September. I have a couple music videos that I'm excited to share with all of you that I have directed. And it's time to take a small break so that everyone here on the Talk Easy team can come back renewed in the fall and winter. We will be doing the show from August 25th to pretty much, I think, December 25th. It's a long haul, and we have so many wonderful episodes planned. I can't tell you. I mean, it's people I've been wanting to have on the show for a long time are going to come on. So I'm excited to share that all with you. I'm also excited for the next 5 weeks for you to hear these episodes. Today is with writer, podcaster Malcolm Gladwell. You have perhaps read one of his books, including David and Goliath, Outliers, Blink. He has a, I'm going to say world-renowned, truly world-renowned podcast called Revisionist History. Season 4 of his show is now out through his new podcast company, Pushkin Industries. I did this episode 2 years ago. In New York, at his house. It is, to date, really one of my favorite conversations. I was more researched and prepared than usual, I'll be honest. I had done an ample amount of research for this one. When we originally aired the episode 2 years ago, I set it up in a much more NPR fashion where I described Malcolm's home, and I do want to say Malcolm has the kind of home that you would expect that he has. You know, it is beautiful, but not outlandish, and in the middle of his home is a library where you need a ladder to go up and fetch the books. And it's exactly the kind of home, without, you know, revealing too much more about his personal space, it's exactly the kind of home you'd expect Malcolm Gladwell to have. And yeah, it's one of these conversations that I think oscillates back and forth between his work and in his personal life. And I hope with this episode, like with every episode that we do, you have a better sense of who this man is in the world and in his work, and how his sort of peculiar personality, I'm reluctant to even call it eccentric. I think he is one of these people that just genuinely loves the work that he does. And it's hard to find people like that. It's hard to be someone like that. And he's one of my favorite thinkers out there. So even if you are not a huge Gladwell fan, I would listen to this episode, because I do confront him about some of your potential criticisms, even if I don't personally agree with them. I think one of the reasons I love Malcolm, and even if you don't like Malcolm, that's fine, but he is someone genuinely open to ideas and dialogue and a kind of idiosyncratic discourse that most people are not open to. He just likes ideas, even if they're wrong-headed, even if they don't make too much sense, even if they're just entertaining. He likes to entertain them. And so for the next hour, we entertain a whole bunch of ideas about himself, his work, and everything in between. I really hope you like it, and I will see you next week with another one of my favorite episodes. So, finally, here is Malcolm Gladwell. I want to understand how you arrived at where you are today, and I know that's a big undertaking, but I've been researching for the last couple of days, going through stuff, and I want to start with, in David and Goliath, you talk about this idea of desirable difficulties.
Yeah.
You describe it that, to elaborate on that term, you said, there are sometimes cases when your performance will improve if I make the task of learning more difficult for you. Not always, but what they do is draw a line between difficulties that are ultimately desirable and those that are not. I just want to start in the beginning with this. I mean, you're born in England. You move to Ontario, Canada when you're six.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any of those desirable difficulties or undesired difficulties growing up?
I don't think so. I have looked... without success for evidence of difficulty in my life, and I can't find anything. It's been pretty much...
What a blessing that is, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in like a normal, happy, middle-class family in a stable, prosperous, peaceful, tolerant part of the world. Basically got all my education for free. I mean, had no major periods of unemployment. My health has been good. I mean, I tend to think that people from, if you are upper middle class or middle class, you're educated and you're a reasonably nice person and you can get up in the morning and you live in any part of the developed world, you don't really have any excuses. And you can't, any claim you make to somehow struggling is pretty lame compared to the rest of the world. So I can't locate any real difficulties in my life.
Mm. Well, you're describing a perfect human being, almost an existence without problems. I don't think we have to say they're excuses.
Yeah.
I think you could have had,
I mean, I have issues, but my point is they're not insurmountable or
sure
worthy of, and in that sense, I don't think I'm unusual. I think, you know, most people have, from who share my background do not have insurmountable difficulties.
Mm. Where do you think the rebelliousness came from when you're a teenager? Because you start this zine, it's called Ad Hominem, mm-hmm. Great name. for a zine, by the way.
Thank you.
You run a column called The Moral Pejorative.
Yeah.
You're rallying your students to protest. Your principal getting transferred. That's fairly, as you mentioned in the Ezra Klein Show, that's a fairly unusual thing for someone to do in Canada.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it rebellion. I would call it mischief. I mean, there's a big difference. We were not railing against the status quo or the established order of things. We were, our tongue was in our cheek. You know, it was like we were just having fun with, and Canada being Canada, it wasn't like these rebellious acts were met with any kind of response or objection or...
There was no consequences.
No, it was like, it's like everyone just looked the other way, you know? It's like, or they just kind of rolled their eyes or they were amused by it. I mean, that was our intention was not to rock the boat. Our intention was...
Make fun of the boat?
Make fun of the boat. I mean, it's just like, you know, and the lovely thing about Canada is that people have a sense of humor about this kind of stuff. So it was not, I don't think of myself as being terribly rebellious, but I do think of myself as being mildly mischievous.
Mildly mischievous. So where do you think that comes from? Because you describe a childhood where that behavior is not exactly congruous with how you were raised.
No, my parents are rebellious, actually.
Okay.
I represent the watered-down version of my parents' rebellion. So it comes from them, but it's just kind of... I mean, they had things they rebelled against, real things they rebelled against.
So you're the PG-13 version
I am the PG-13 version of my parents. Both of them, my father's no longer with us, but my mother is. They're both, you know, there's a real badass element to the two of them in a very genteel, carefully disguised way. But my mother is not someone you mess with, and my father is someone who did not require the approval of the world to do anything that he wanted to do.
Did you inherit some of those qualities?
Well, like I said, I inherited a very... I mean, it's watered down. By the time it hits me, it's pretty watered down, but it's...
Should someone mess with you?
People can mess with me. The difference is, if you mess with me, I just don't get upset.
See, that's what I had an impression. This is my feeling about you.
Yeah, I don't... I used to... There was a time in my life when I took offense at this kind of stuff, and now I'm just... I just can't... bring myself. I can't muster any kind of indignation.
that's an impressive feat.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's a kind of... I think what people do is they tend to exaggerate. You know, there's a human tendency to take your critics more seriously than your supporters. So you have 10 critics and 10 supporters, and what you do is you obsess about your 10 critics and you forget about your 10 supporters. And I sort of, at a certain point in my life, realized, this is crazy. If I have 10 supporters, why do I care if I have 10 critics? I got 10 people who like me. And in real life, in fact, the breakdown's not like that. You know, most people who are producing something creative, the ratio of supporters to critics is 9-1 or 9.5-1. You never have more critics than supporters. There's always people who can find, and people just kind of mindlessly focus on the small number of vocal
dissenters.
Why? It's totally bananas way to live your life. So you know, if I now I just ignore them. It's like, what's the point?
The why is the biggest part of that, though, because I've often tried to figure that with my own life. Is people say, oh, you do this well, or you've written this that's interesting, and then there's two people on Twitter that said, oh, this person's terrible.
Yeah,
and I can recall with stunning clarity the words and the verbiage they used against me. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't tell you the praise at all, anything that's generic.
Yeah, yeah. I'm with you. That's very, very human tendency. And you have to kind of, you've got to make a conscious decision to reverse your critical polarity.
Do we want to be liked? It seems like too basic of an explanation.
I don't know whether is it that we want to be liked, or is it that just that we're just more sensitive about We're so acutely aware of our flaws,
right,
that when someone identifies them, we feel it's wounded in some special
right.
way.
Like know? They know something that only I'm supposed to know.
Exactly.
Or yeah. rather, they know something maybe I didn't even consider.
Yeah. The other part of this strategy is not strategy, but approach to life is you just have to own up to your flaws. I mean, as opposed to trying to hide them, just like cop to them.
Okay. And so what are those?
Well, you know, I oversimplify things sometimes? Sure. Am I unnecessarily provocative in certain times or places? Absolutely. You know, do I...
Is golfing considered crack?
Is golf? Yeah, it's like, these are not... None of this is news to me. I can tell you what the critics are going to say. Do I flip-flop on things? All the time. You know, in fact, I pride myself on how much I change my mind.
I think flip-flopping is actually not a real thing. Or rather, it should not be viewed negatively.
I'm with you. Totally with
you. It's an absurd way of going through life.
It's the dumbest thing in the world that we should ever attack someone for flip-flopping. Flip-flopping is one of the great delights and pleasures of being a sentient human is...
Change your mind.
Yeah, discovering something you didn't know was true and then like realizing, oh, wow, that means... I have to go back and like reverse my position on all kinds. That's a sign of someone who's alive in the world.
I wanted to go on this oversimplification thing. Mm-hmm. This has been talked about ad nauseum, I'd say.
Yeah.
But I wanted to break this down because I just want to get it over with. Mm-hmm. And you said in 2013 on that David and Goliath book tour, you said, if my books appear to a reader to be oversimplified, then you shouldn't read them. You're not the audience.
Yeah.
Which seemed fair. Uh-huh. On this quote, Christopher Chabris, who I will remove my feelings about this person for now.
Yeah.
He wrote in Slate, but consider what Gladwell's quote means. He's saying that if you understand his topics well enough to see what is erroneous or missing, then you are not the reader he wants. At a stroke, he has said that anyone equipped to critically review his work should not be reading it. How convenient.
Oh, I mean, first of all, that was someone who was engaged in the active process of coming up with reasons to disagree with me. That's a very tendentious reading of that. What I meant was as follows. On anything that you know a lot about, you inevitably find... popular discourse frustrating. So there are two things in the world that I know a great deal about: track and field and cars. If I read an article for the general audience about a track and field, about an athlete, a runner, whatever, I'm invariably halfway through, I throw up my hands and say, can't believe they said that. What are they talking about? Don't you know anything about running? And then I stop myself. I think, oh, wait a minute. It's not for me.
Right.
Right? I'm assuming you're not a big track and field fan.
No, but I'm thinking I imagine this is how Bill Simmons approaches most NBA writing.
Yeah. So for me to talk to you in a way that will make you interested in track and field, I have to change the way I talk about track and field. If you are someone if you're my friend David Epstein, who knows an insane amount about track, we have a totally different conversation. One conversation is not wrong and the other is right. They're different. They have a different intention.
There's a spectrum.
Yeah, where I'm trying to engage in the sport. David's already engaged. David and I are quibbling at the finer, you know, at the edges of the, right? And that's what, you know, Chabris is misunderstanding what I'm saying. I'm saying when I write about psychology for a general audience, it is not the same conversation I will have with another psychologist, but it is by definition different. Just as when he talks to his graduate students, he talks in a different way than he does to his freshman class. Right? It's not that he's making stuff up for his freshman class. It's that they don't know anything about psychology, so he has to talk in a different way. Same thing, you know. So it's like, that seems to me such an obvious point that outside of our... And it's why one of the best ways for me to avoid feeling frustrated and throwing something across the room is not to read articles on track and field that are intended for a general audience. It's a very simple way to solve this problem, right? And that's what I'm saying. Look, You have a PhD from Harvard in social psychology. You should not be reading David and Goliath. It's going to frustrate you, right?
Well, I have to say, I love the image of you on your computer finding a track and field article and be like, God damn it. No, not again.
I can't believe you're saying this. Right? But of course you do that, right? That's the you know, it's like a, and it's, like I said, the only other place I have that is with cars. I read like the review of cars. I do it just to kind of bait myself. In the back of the Sunday Wall Street Journal, they always have a review. A
car review.
Yeah. Dan Neal.
I didn't know this, but yeah. Okay.
Dan Neal writes, and Dan Neal is writing for a general audience, and I actually really like Dan Neal. But I read him, and every time I read him, I'm like, oh, I can't believe you said that. And then I realize, oh, wait a minute, not for me. Somebody else. Is it Dan Neal? Am I making it up? It's someone like that. Anyway, whoever it is, and if he's listening, I love your stuff, and I have to stop myself from complaining because you're not writing for me. Mm-hmm.
This seems like a fair and obvious explanation. Mm-hmm. I've heard you make it in so many other words before, and yet it hasn't gone away.
Nah, it's never going to go away. It's fine.
Is that how it is?
I mean, it's like you can't. The thing is, you have to at some point surrender the notion that you can win over your critics. You're not going to win them over. There's no point. Oh, by the way, it's unnecessary. My job as a writer is not to convince people who think that I'm an idiot that I'm not an idiot. That's not my job. If you think I'm an idiot, I can't. There's nothing I can do. I'm not going to change your mind, right? Mm. You're not into me. It's fine. I, you know, just as no one is ever going to convince me that, you know, to like Beyonce's music. I don't like Beyonce's music. I just don't. And there's no scenario where she's going to put out an album that I'm going to like, right?
Well, now the headlines for this podcast are going to be Malcolm Gladwell doesn't like Beyonce.
And by the way, I am self-aware enough to know that she's a genius, and many, many people who know a lot more about music really, really dig her. Uh-huh. She's hugely important. It just so happens, though, that my interest in what she does don't coincide. But Beyonce should not sit up at night and say, what can I do to win over Gladwell? She's doing just fine. Her job is to appeal to people who like Beyonce, right?
Again, another great image is Beyonce.
Yeah, unrest. Not like she's not wasting any time on Malcolm Gladwell's musical taste.
But you're also talking about journalism on a whole. I've heard you say that journalists tend to react and respond in lockstep. This is a thing you find to be problematic in contemporary journalism. You say people should be different for the sake of being different.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, what makes you different?
What makes me different?
Yeah.
I would say it first, much more simply, which is that I don't have a lot of anxiety about my position in the world. So I don't feel like I have anything to lose by saying whatever's on my mind. Some people genuinely do have kind of anxiety about that kind of stuff. For whatever reason, I don't particularly understand why, I don't. And so,
is that true across the board when it comes to anxiety?
I'm not a terribly anxious person. I mean, I'm anxious about very, very specific things that don't really have to do with my career. I have never really worried about my career. To the extent I worry about personal things, not professional things.
Like friendships or relationships.
But my job has always been for me, like, like I said before, if you are willing to wake up in the morning and you're reasonably nice, and you live in the developed world, the world is set up for you. Like, you can't, it's just really hard to fail. Mm. So my position has always been, look, I'm not gonna fail, it's fine. I mean, I'll like figure a way. And, you know, knock on wood, so far, things have worked out pretty well. So I feel like what prevents people from sometimes doing interesting things is they have an anxiety about stepping outside of a narrow definition of what they're good at. Mm. I don't. It's why I did the podcast, for example. You know, there is one, I was trying a new, it is a very different medium, which of course it never even occurred to me that it was until I got halfway through. I was like, oh my goodness, this is very different. But it never occurred to me not to do it because it was different and strange. I was like, whatever, let's try it. Maybe it'll fail, in which case I'll just go back to writing articles for The New Yorker. I mean, it wasn't, I didn't spend a lot of time worrying about it. I just did it. And
pretty good backup plan, by the way.
Yes, I have a good backup. But I mean, that's part of what I'm saying.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not rational for someone like me to have anxiety. I have, for all the reasons I've enumerated, and also, you know, the fact that I was at a time in my career where there's just zero penalty for failure. So why should I pretend there is? Why should I drum up some imaginary neurosis when, you know, none? There's no reason for it.
Do you think this? Do you think what you're saying applies specifically to you? And I guess maybe more specifically, what I'm saying is, does someone or does anyone have to reach a certain level of success to get to the place of, well, I'll just try anything because why not?
Yeah.
Did you start from that point?
I had that attitude. You know, my earliest jobs were in essentially on the conservative end of the media spectrum. And I took those jobs because I was sort of conservative at the time, but also because they were jobs. You know, at one point I was working for Insight magazine, which was owned by the Reverend Moon. You know, it's like, it's sort of embarrassing in retrospect, but like, whatever. It was like a year job, paid the bills, learned a lot, had fun, traveled around. You know, I don't know. It's like, you can take stuff too seriously and sort of overthink stuff. There's a lot of overthinking. People in this is one of the things, I mean, there's a reason I'm so obsessed with writing about higher education in America. And that is for a number of reasons. And one is this, the extent to which people agonize about something where they go to college on the assumption that that is going to determine the trajectory of their lives, which is just so nonsense to me. I mean, no part of that makes any sense to me. And I just think, what kind of weird mindset says that a decision you make at 17 is going to, or 18, is going to affect the rest of your career? That's just bananas.
Not only affect it, but irrevocably affect it.
It's bananas. Like, no way. Does anyone care where, what percentage of my readers know where I went to college or even remotely care? A better question is, what percent care? I would say the answer is something like 0.00005%. No one cares. Do I care where any of my friends, I can't even tell you where half my friends, when I think about my friends, actually, my close group of friends, you know, some of them went to fancy schools. Some of them went to the least fancy schools on the, one of my best friends went to Abilene Christian. Does that fact in any way enter my mind when I'm talking to him? Never. Who cares? It was like it was in the 80s. It's like, the 80s is like so long ago that, you know, it's like the statute of limitations has run out on Abilene Christian. So it's like, you know, this stuff, there's just these kind of, there's a great book written by, I think it was Jerome Bruner, great psychologist at NYU about 20 years ago. I have it over there. It's called Three Seductive Ideas. And one of the seductive ideas that he's objecting to is the notion of that our lives are overly determined by our origins, which he thinks is a misreading of Freud. And the college thing is a version of that, that we just think everything. So is the idea that if you don't get the right kind of stimulus in your first 3 years, you're toast. These are all versions of the same delusion, which says that everything is kind of set in stone as a youth, and then that you can't get off that trajectory for the rest of your life, which I just think is craziness.
I find it crazy, but you have to understand, for my generation, I'm 22. I did 2 years of school and I left. We're taught this. We're taught that it irrevocably affects your life. We're taught that this is a path you go down or you leave it.
Yeah.
And so people my age, I mean, there is a mass, to get back to this, there is a mass anxiety.
Yeah.
Because we were told since 15, freshman high school, you better start figuring out where you're going to go to college.
So crazy.
Like, you better figure out what your major is. You better figure out what you want to do with your life. You better figure out how to do a 401k. You better figure out how to do... So this is just what was told to me. And I didn't go to, I went to a public high school in California.
Yeah. But they ruined your adolescence, which should have been the most fun 5 years of your life.
Not mine.
Not yours, but in your
generation. Because I had great parents.
Yeah.
Who said, well,
yeah,
do what you got to do.
Yeah. I don't remember worrying about anything in my teenage years. It was fantastic.
Were you just a happy person then?
No, it was a happy environment. It was, there nobody was worried about any of these things. Very few people in my high school went to college. The colleges, it's Canada. You write down on a piece of paper where you want to go and they let you in. it's like
a piece of paper like this. The
literally.
The ripped piece of paper.
No. That's not a metaphor. I wrote, you get a piece of paper with the colleges in Ontario listed, and you rank them in the order that you'd like to attend them, and then you mail a piece of paper off to a central government processing unit. That is how you apply to college.
There's no note?
Then your school sends your grades, and you're done. That's it. It's different now. This is a long time ago, but because I'm old. But no, it's like, wait, I worried about it for like a day. And then I was done. And then I worried about anything.
I want to ask you that. Well, what?
Back then, I worried about stuff later, but not back then. Mm-hmm. If you're 16, what would you worry about?
Well, I won't give you my laundry list, Malcolm. But were you an engaged teenage kid? What were you like? Were you optimistic, naive?
I had a friend whose name is Terry.
This is the person you started the zine with, him and Howard?
Yes, that's right. So Terry Martin, who was this enormous influence on me, and he was a completely fearless, intellectually fearless person who thought of the world, who sort of taught me this incredible lesson, which I sort of knew, but he kind of... he accentuated it. He taught me that the world was our oyster. That it's like, it's all out there. You just have to find it. It's super fun. If you're interested in something, we used to play hooky from school for like huge amounts of time, but not to goof off, to do better schoolwork. Because our whole idea was, school's not hard enough. Let's make it hard. Let's make it hard on our own. And so we convinced our moms, look, we have this thing we want to do. We're going to stay home for the next 2 weeks. Just send a note and just tell us that. Our moms were totally complicit in this. But Terry was kind of like that. He wasn't... Terry later, to give you a sense of what he was like, he wanted to write a history of his grandparents who were Russian immigrants. They were Mennonites, came from Russia. And so he taught himself Russian. Do you understand? When he was like 20.
Yeah.
He's that kind of guy because he wanted to read original sources into Russian. So when you have that kind of attitude, and I don't think it occurred to him that might be hard. He was like, whatever. I have time. I'm 20. No, I'll start doing it. What's the worst that could happen? I don't learn Russian, right? It's not like it's wasted time. I could be playing video games. That was his kind of... I found him that to have that example as a 14-year-old in your life is just sort of intoxicating.
Hmm. 2 years ago at 20, before my grandfather passed, or maybe around right when he passed, and my grandmother's still alive, they came from Mexico and they only can speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And my Spanish it's atrocious.
Mm-hmm.
It's bad. I thought, I'm going to learn the language enough so that I can say goodbye or give him some final note.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought this was a great idea in the way that your friend learned Russian.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't do it. I haven't done it.
Yeah.
And this is an odd detour, I admit.
Now. You've got time.
Do I?
Yeah, you do. You got all the time in the world.
What do you make of that? The idea of having time to do things. We always worry so much that time is just evaporating.
You're 22. You're you're 31 years younger than I am. You got time. I have time, and I'm, you know, 53.
And so. Yet you seem more optimistic than I am.
Yeah, maybe I am an optimist.
Do you think so?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I come from pretty optimistic stock, so yeah, there's a powerful genetic component in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
We're not people who dwell on, mostly because the narrative of my parents' lives was a narrative of, not to sound corny, but of dreams coming true. They got what they wanted from, more than they wanted from the world. And that was, I think, something that was very true of their generation as well. This is the generation born just before the Second World War that witnessed, you know, the kind of golden age of the West. And not just witnessed it, participated in this golden age. What's not to like? Like, that's pretty damn good. If you had to pick a time to be born in human history, 1934 is pretty good time when my mother was born, when my dad was, actually, I was, the early 30s, essentially. Pretty good time to be born, right?
Do you think it's worked out for you in that way? I remember you talking about when you're in D.C., writing, you were an immigrant at the time, right? You had not become a citizen yet.
Still have not become a citizen, but
okay. Well, knock on wood.
Yes.
You were talking about how you wanted to make your fortune.
Mm-hmm.
I've been thinking about that. You've said that on the Ezra Klein show, and I've been wondering what does that mean?
Make my fortune?
Well, for you, what does that mean?
I think it just meant establish an independent life for myself, you know. There's a feeling, as a kid, you know, I like many teenagers, more than teenagers, as like many kids, I had a series of obsessions, things that I was, you know, really into cars and really into sports and really into, and I would, when you reflect on that, you realize the reason you do that as a kid is that you're very attracted to the notion of mastery. You want to, what you want is the feeling that there is a particular world which you, not control, because it's way too strong, but understand that, you know, the world is this huge, vast, disorienting, confusing place, but there's a little corner of it that you know. You know, I knew running. I could tell you who won the 5,000 meters of the 1972 Munich Games and what his time was, right? So that, no matter what was going on in the world, I knew, and I could tell you, I could look out on the street and I could identify every car that went past. Like, make, model, year, right? That's what I knew. And that, you know, when I say I want to make my fortune, what I meant was I wanted to do that on a slightly larger scale. I wanted to participate in a world where I understood the world. I had a place in it. I understood how it worked. I knew the major players. I knew the rules. If I had to go back and interrogate what my ambition was as a 22-year-old, that's what it was, to master that in the same way that I had mastered track and field as a 13-year-old.
Mm. Do you think with each passing book or even the podcast that you're figuring that out? Your place in the world, or rather your corner of the world, a little bit more?
I think so. I think I have my own little corner. I don't think it's necessarily a very big corner, but I have a little corner. People know where to find me. They know what happens in my corner.
What happens?
You know, there's a kind of steady flow of hijinks of one level or another. I don't mean that in an entire, not everything I do is mischievous, but I mean, you know, stuff happens. There's going to be some flow of ideas coming out.
At the very least, it's not boring.
So, yeah, it won't be boring. You know, some of it's going to be dumb. Some of it's going to work. I don't know. It's like, they just know what's over there. And it's, And I have identified other corners
yeah.
that I like to participate in at the same time. You mm-hmm. know, I know, and I take enormous pleasure. I love, you know, I'm still an obsessive track fan, and there's this website called Let's Run, which all the serious runners read. And nothing gives me more pleasure than hanging out in the message boards of Let's Run. Because it's just like so hilariously specific. Like there was one trope, it just cracks me up so much. Paul Ryan, last election season, was talking about how he used to be a marathoner. And he, you know, do you remember this? He lied about his marathon time. He said that he had run a 3-hour marathon and he'd actually run a 4-hour marathon. And he claimed 3 hours, and then all the runners went back to try and fact check this because he didn't say where he'd run it. And they discovered, no, he'd run a 4-hour. Now, just so you know, the difference between a 3-hour and a 4-hour marathon is the difference between, I mean, I can't even tell you. It's the difference between A and Z. It's like 4-hour is you're a jogger
right.
and you run 3 times a week for 6 miles. 3 hours is, that is, you have to be super serious to run 3 hours.
This I know because my mom has run 10
yes.
marathons.
Okay.
And one time she qualified for the Boston Marathon, which is harder to qualify for.
Yeah, yeah.
And for her age group, she made it. But I know the difference. She always would say, like, this person beat me by 32 minutes. And I'm like, that's not that much. Yeah, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
Of time.
So for him to lie about this is huge.
It's huge.
I mean, it's like, it doesn't make any sense. So runners have not forgiven him about this. But every now and again, there's someone will post something about that liar, Paul Ryan. And some part of me just surges in pride every time I say that. It's like, that's so fantastic. I love that we nailed him on this thing. And by the way,
an insane lie. It's like
an insane lie.
I played high school basketball, which I did, and I also played a few games in the NBA, which would be a huge stretch.
Yeah, that's right.
A huge stretch. People would be like, no, you didn't play.
Yes, exactly. It's like, yeah, I tried out for the Warriors.
It was pre-Klay Thompson, Steph yeah. Curry.
No, you didn't. It's funny.
What is the most ridiculous, or to use your word, dumb theory that you have spent way too much time thinking was actually true?
Oh my God, such a good question. What is the most ridiculous step? Oh, you know what it is? I'm obsessed with this. It's my favorite JFK assassination theory, which I understand is not true. I accept it intellectually, but I can't accept it emotionally because it's such the perfect theory. It's the one that says that JFK was... It says that the first two shots that did not kill JFK were fired by Lee Harvey Oswald. But the third and fatal shot, which is the one that all the controversy is about, was an accidental shot from the Secret Service agent in the car behind him.
Right.
I love this theory so much. It's so fantastic. Because it diffuses 50 years of conspiracy talk and just says, you know what? It was just a dumb accident. Some guy panicked and his gun went off and happened to hit the president. And that's why the president died. And that's why we've been going through this for years and years and years.
It's not any more ridiculous than the magic bullet or the...
Well, this is the explanation for the magic bullet, that the bullet came from... Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, yes.
Well, do you remember the Seinfeld episode?
Oh, yeah.
Where they do the magical loogie and it ricochets off Newman and then it hits him in the leg and then it bounces back.
Yeah.
I mean, that's based on the ridiculousness of the magic bullet. The accident... I love this.
It's a great theory.
I would go down this rabbit hole too, though.
I don't think it's true. There's a whole book written about it.
You read this whole book.
Yeah, of course. I desperately want it to be true. I fear it's not, and it breaks my heart.
Why do you think it's not true? I'm just curious now.
Some guy who I knew from way back in the day, who actually knows what he's talking about, a very serious journalist, who now runs some website devoted to JFK.
Right.
Denounced, I mentioned this on a Bill Simmons, either a podcast or in a back and forth with Simmons, that it was my favorite theory. And this guy like took me to task so ruthlessly, convincingly, and thoroughly that I was like, you know what, I should stop doing this in public. And he knows. I mean, I don't know. I haven't, you know, there's 100 books written on this. I've read one of them and is convinced by the one. You should not listen to me on this subject. So if this guy name's Jeff Morley, if Jeff Morley thinks it's horseshit, it's horseshit.
From the first season of Revisionist History, Do you remember an episode, or rather a theory, that people seem to get most infuriated by?
Because I've listened infuriated.
Yes, one that was like, I don't think that doesn't add up to me. Because there was one for me that I wasn't infuriated by, but I was surprised by. Yeah. And it's the one where we sort of like manifest destiny, or like we sort of manifest this problem of us driving the car.
Oh, yeah.
And the way the foot pivots back and forth, or rather doesn't move.
Yeah.
Can you actually, for context, can you explain that a little bit better?
That was about the Toyota sudden acceleration controversy. And, you know, these cars were 8 years ago mysteriously accelerating, and Toyota ended up paying out billions of dollars to all kinds of victims. It turns out that the likeliest explanation of what happened is that people had put their foot on the accelerator thinking it was the brake. And it turns out this is very common. It's called pedal error. People do this all the time. And so we had constructed this huge scenario about what Toyota had allegedly done wrong and how they had committed all kinds of malpractice in the way they made their cars, but it was just people making a dumb mistake. There were some people who refused to believe that, who got all upset about it. Weirdly,
maybe I'm connecting it to, that's where this came up, honestly, is that the idea of an accident, the accidental shooting.
Yeah.
This to me seems like a human error. But it's an accident. It's not even intentional.
No, it's just an accident. Very understandable one. It's very hard to find a car person who thinks otherwise. So all the car guys, every single person who knows something about cars says, oh, it's just pedal error. They put their foot on the accelerator and they thought it was a brake. Software people really, really believe there was something weird about the Toyota software. And they have these incredibly elaborate theories that violate every principle of intellectual simplicity. So, like, they try to come up with these long, complicated discussions about this line of code does this instead of this. Like, dude, you know, there are sensors in a car that tell you whether the brake was engaged. And when these cars get into accidents, we look at the sensor, and the sensor says the brake was never engaged. We don't need another complicated explanation. We know. The person didn't put their foot on the brake, right? It's not hard, right? So some people love the complicated explanation. I like the simple one, at least in that instance I do.
The simple one is often human error.
Yeah,
and I don't know if people want to...
They don't like those narratives. Yeah.
Why is that?
I don't know. I guess we're just protecting... People are scared of... I don't know. It's like, I mean, it's sort of... I suppose it's understandable that people would rather not admit to some fault of their own. Maybe it's because... These moments are so terrifying that the only way to make sense of the terror, if your car is accelerating out of control, the only way to make sense of it is to say there must be some dark conspiratorial reason for it.
To deflect.
Yeah, to kind of just, not even to deflect, just to kind of process what you feel. Because you're so terrified, the idea that you caused it through your own carelessness or inadvertent carelessness must be just really hard to accept.
Is there something like that that's happened to you? Something that you didn't want to accept, that you did something wrong?
I'm sure. In the spur of the moment, I can't think of something, but I'm quite convinced there have been many instances of that. I don't think I'm any different from anybody else in this respect. You know, we have difficulty with these kinds of problems.
I guess I bring this up because I reread the story today, How David Beats Goliath. This is a year after Outliers comes out, and you say David's victory over Goliath in the biblical account is held to be an anomaly. It was not. David's win all the time. David can beat Goliath by substituting effort for ability, and substituting effort for ability turns out to be a winning formula for underdogs in all walks of life. So I think you said this on long form. Eventually, if done right, all Davids become Goliath.
Yeah, I think so, probably, yeah. Not all, but many.
Many. I'm thinking about this and how it mirrors your career. You start as American Spectator, then go to the Washington Post, Upstart. You write about AIDS, and you write about the White House. You do all this stuff as a journalist. Your life doesn't look much like that anymore, in that you're not a post journalist you're making cold calls. Not that you don't do that for your show, but you have become one of the most recognized public intellectuals in North America, at the very least. So you've become Goliath.
Well, Goliath, I mean, Jay-Z is Goliath. So let's put this in perspective. I become, less of an underdog than I was in the past.
Public intellectuals wise.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you say, let's not compare ourselves to Kanye and Jay-Z, because we'll always lose that battle, Malcolm. This is like if I was comparing myself to LeBron and Jordan, I would lose. I'd be sad about myself.
But that happens. Yeah, I mean, I've been around for a long time, so I am much better known than I was in the past. It hasn't changed. The only reason I'm resisting this a little bit is that it hasn't changed what I do. I'm still doing essentially a version of what I was doing back then. It's different in its form, and it's different. It might be easier now or more complicated or whatever, but it's still, I haven't morphed into a different person or taken on a different job. I'm still at it. So that's why it doesn't seem like that I have metamorphosized into something else.
Are you resistant to it because a lot of people perhaps believe that it has changed you, or that it ought to have changed you?
I don't know if people believe that.
I think maybe that's the surface reading of someone who becomes as successful as you have.
Yeah.
They think this person is X, 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 and X, and they have these qualities, and now they're big and famous and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I don't know. I haven't thought about that. Because I don't feel different, I just can't imagine. I just don't go down that road. I feel like I'm exactly the same. So I don't, I just don't indulge those sorts of scenarios in my head. I don't feel like I make different choices now. I mean, I know stuff I didn't know before. But I'm not, I'm doing podcasts now, writing books. Wasn't doing that when I started out, but it's the same basic. I'm engaged in the same basic process.
Well, I'm glad you pushed back on that, because it's a theory I had.
Yeah, yeah.
And you didn't like it.
By the way, you might be true. What you say might be true. I'm just saying I may in fact be totally different and not realize it, which is, would be, by the way, totally plausible, right?
Mm.
Most of the ways in which we change, we may be unaware of. So
I think it would be fine, by the way. The premise for my thing is, it's okay to be Goliath. I don't think there's no pejorative. I think it's fine.
Yeah.
I think you've put in a lot of work. You've had the mix of effort and ability.
Yeah.
And that's something to applaud, I mean, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't like the idea of getting big. That's why I'm resisting it a little bit. I just find it a little bit, my response to it. I'm never someone who looks at a celebrity and says, I wish that was my life. I sort of think the lives of celebrities sound terrifying to me. So I sort of like, that's, I wouldn't wish that on anyone, that kind of being in the spotlight. I don't particularly want to be scrutinized personally the way that we scrutinize celebrities personally, So that, I'm not interested in that. I didn't do this to become well known. I did this because I enjoy creating these little things.
The criticism has been confounding to me for the most part, and I've always wondered, do you think, is receiving more criticism just a byproduct of becoming more recognizable? Is it just a volume game?
It's a volume game, just a volume game. Your critics are just a constant percentage of your readers. So if you have more readers, you have more critics. It's nothing more than that. It's an illusion to think that that you attract more critics as you grow in stature, or attract a larger portion of critics. You attract when you can find lots and lots of people who denounce John Grisham novels. Why? Because the man sells 100 million, has probably sold in his life, I don't know how many, 500 million books. If you sell 500 million books, you're going to have 1 million critics, right? There's no way around it. That's just, so you can't, it is not, if John Grisham were to get obsessed with his 1 million critics, he would be an idiot because he has 499 million fans, right?
Didn't you write a review of his stuff in the New Republic?
I have written, what have I written about Grisham?
I found something
today.
I always
wanted to write something. Yes, I did once about, years ago.
It was in 96.
Yeah, good Lord, you do your homework, don't you?
That seemed...
Even I had forgotten it.
That seemed like you weren't excited that I did my homework.
No, I was. I mean, I am very impressed. I kind of liked that article. Was that about smoking?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's right. I was proud of that.
It's a good piece.
Yeah, I still... It's one of those pieces from 20 years ago that I think that is still my position. That
this is back to the flip-flopping.
Yeah, I have not flip-flopped on the idea that the argument from addiction is much more important than the argument from choice. The reason we're upset about tobacco companies and opioid sellers and all those kinds of people is not that they have distorted our choices, but they have removed our choice. By virtue of selling an addictive product, they have removed the capacity for choice. And you can't use a choice paradigm to evaluate their behavior. And you can't say, if only we were better educated about opioids, we wouldn't have so many overdoses. It's not about being educated about it. It's the fact that you take it and you're addicted, right? It's like this kind of confusion, this notion that we want to think that, the same rules apply to hamburgers as apply to painkillers. It's not true, right?
Seems like a false equivalency.
Yeah.
But choice has been something you've been fascinated in seemingly your whole... I love the TED Talk you did in 2004 where you're talking about choice and selection and options.
Mm-hmm.
That was 13 years ago. The options have multiplied tenfold. But there's a quote that's great that you say, people don't know what they want.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that still stands?
Oh, yeah. I think it's been true for as long as people have been around. I mean, we think we know what we want. We make choices. But invariably, I think our reasons are much deeper than we're aware of. And also, the real reason we don't know what we want is that we don't know what's out there. One of the wonderful things about it being a human being and consuming art, other people's art, and I mean that broadly, very broadly, is that they surprise you, right? You read something and that blows you away. I didn't know that that would bring me pleasure. If you'd asked me, I've been recently listening to the, and I'm going to mispronounce their name, is it the Avett Brothers? They're a country band. Kind of a cool country band. And if you'd asked me before I listened to the Avett Brothers, would you like a kind of neo-traditionalist kind of alt country something from the South, guys with tattoos? If you did the whole thing, I'd be like, I don't know. I couldn't identify that as, I wouldn't have given it in my list of things that would bring me pleasure. But then I hear it and I'm like, oh, good Lord, that's good. I had no idea, right? There's no choice in that. I didn't choose the Avett Brothers because I thought that would bring me pleasure. I stumbled on the Avett brothers, and was stunned to learn they bring me pleasure. And that second condition is far more not just prevalent, but powerful. I think most of what brings you pleasure is the stuff that you would never have thought brings you pleasure.
Do you think that's because the art chooses you?
Because the what?
Do you think that's because the art chooses you?
Yeah. Or that you don't know you can't put a fence around your imagination. We always think we can. We always want to kind of define our imaginations using the vocabulary and experiences we already have. But our imagination is so much larger than we are. Then our unconscious is interested in vastly more than we're aware of. And so we're always going to be wonderfully and beautifully surprised by what's out there.
Mm. Something that I would describe as wonderful and beautiful is, and this is going to sound odd, but right as I had the drive over here, I was listening to your intro for season 2. And you say, I have a weakness for the big idea, maybe a fatal weakness. On my tombstone, it's going to say, Malcolm Gladwell, rest in peace. His one big idea is that there was one big idea to explain everything.
Yeah. I'm making fun of myself in that, very clearly.
I find that wonderful. What I found most wonderful about that comment is not only the sentiment behind it, but the placement of it, which is that here's season 2 of the show. Forget anything else. I'm going to lead with this fucking thing.
Yeah.
That everyone has been saying. Here it is. And you know what? I'm leaning into it.
Yeah. The great thing about the podcast is that the opportunities for a kind of playful self-parody are epic. And basically,
who knew?
If you listen, there's a couple of episodes which really I am just making fun of myself. I mean, in a kind of like...
In season 2?
Yeah. In a kind of a high-end way. I'm just like saying, at a certain point, Malcolm Gladwell is ridiculous. And here's me being ridiculous. Let's just roll with it and see what... the one I recorded today is... Yeah, I mean, it's absurd. I mean, it's just me. Just,
what's so absurd?
I mean, it's like... It's absurd in a good, fun way, in a way that I like absurd. Which is, you take a germ of a good idea, and then you just like... push it as far as it can be humanly pushed until the point that there's a point in this episode that I did today where if you know a lot about music, you're going to get really upset because I'm just fucking with you. I mean, I really just am. I go after the Rolling Stones. I mean, it's just like, it's just absurd kind of, but it's fun and it ends up somewhere, I think, important. And I, you know, there's this thing I've always believed, which is that, ideas can be as fun as and entertaining as anything. Mm. There's no reason why just because we're dealing with ideas, we have to get all serious. We can enjoy ourselves, right? You could take an idea and play with it for 40 minutes. And if it's absurd at the end, whatever, just like put it down and move on with your life. But you can have fun for 40 minutes playing with this idea, right? And that's what some of them are we're just goofing around with interesting ideas.
So is it okay when critics call you an entertainer?
I don't think of that as a criticism. I think that is the highest of praise. you know, in the way that, you know, really great teachers are entertainers. You know, anyone who can communicate something important in a way that is unexpectedly delightful or moving or engaging is an entertainer. That's kind of that word is not pejorative in my book.
Why do you think people want to hear you communicate something? What do you think it is about you that you present an idea and an audience says, okay, I'm in?
I don't know. I mean, I think I have I have a track record. You know, I built up a certain amount of trust over the years, and people know I'm a known quantity. They know They have a vague, at least a, better than a vague idea of what they're in for.
But they didn't in the beginning.
No, but in the beginning I had a much smaller audience. So I think, you know, I think the thing to remember is that I've been doing this for 30 years, right? So I started out as a journalist in the 80s. So it's like, that's a very important thing to keep in mind. I have been painstakingly putting together this audience for a generation.
Painstakingly?
Yeah. I mean, it's been slow and steady. I mean, it was a kind of 10 years at the Washington Post, you know, another 20 years at the New Yorker, you know, years before the Washington Post, you know, in the kind of magazine world of Washington, D.C. I mean, it's been a long, steady process.
Are you tired?
No. I mean, no, I'm enjoying myself. Why would I? There's no reason to be tired.
I don't know. That sounds, I mean, 30 years is a bit. I think it would be okay if you said to me, yeah, I'm a little exhausted.
No. I mean, maybe one day I'll be exhausted. I mean, I'm still, I still find it really fun, and I'm, you know, finding new ways to amuse myself. So,
The last thing I wanted to bring up to you is that back to that TED Talk in 2004, you're talking about Howard Moskowitz, and the last line you say is that that is the final and I think most beautiful lesson of Howard Moskowitz, that embracing the diversity of human beings, we will find a sure way to true happiness.
Mm-hmm.
This is maybe too sentimental for you.
Mm-hmm.
But have you found that?
Me personally?
Yeah.
I mean, not wholly. But I do think that idea has helped me make sense of a lot of things that might otherwise perplex me or discourage me. Which is, you have to start from the position that everybody's different and everyone processes things differently. And the contents of your own mind are not shared by those around you. And when you keep that in mind, it it just makes life a lot more livable. You know, when you remember, even in the most prosaic moment, when you are on talking to a customer service rep and you're losing patience and you just want to yell at them, and then you remember this person does this for a living. They talk to people like you all day long, and their life experience then is profoundly different from yours, right? When you understand that, they're not in the same, they don't come at this from your direction, they come at this from the other direction of having to deal with these complaints all day long. And when you realize that, you're like, oh, and you can relax. You're like, why am I angry at this person? I mean, making like that's a very, very simple prosaic version of that same idea that the person on the other end of the line is not in your position. They're in a different, and that's true all the way down the line. In everything you do, the people you're dealing with are occupying a different spot in the universe. And if you try hard not to forget that, then your life is easier. It's just way easier, right? There's just less opportunities for getting mad at the world.
That was a expectedly a beautiful calculation of how to be happy, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Malcolm, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. This is really fun. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. I want to give a special thanks this week to Malcolm Gladwell. If you'd like to hear season 4 of his new show, you can visit their website at revisionisthistory.com. If you'd like to learn more about Malcolm, you can do so on our website at talkeasypod.com. Our show is available to stream on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. I also want to give a special thanks to Talk Easy listener Adam Leishman for making a generous donation to the show. If you would like to learn how to help us out, you can visit our site at talkeasypod.com/donate. As always, our show is executive produced by David Chen, graphics by Ian Jones, illustrations by Krishna Shenoy, our intern is Ghani Zur, our music is by Dylan Peck and Jin Sang, our associate producer is Ian Chang, who will be leaving us as of next week. We wish him well in New York, and the show would not be where it is without him. So, much love to our friend Ian Chang. The show is also produced by the wonderful Neil Innes, and I'm Sam Fragoso. This is Talk Easy. I will see you back here next Sunday with another one of my favorite episodes. Hope you all have a good week. So long, everyone.